From the nation's capital, this is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Ladies and gentlemen, our show today is Measuring Recidivism. We have folks from the Urban Institute, Ryan King. He is a senior fellow with the Justice Policy Center, again, at Urban Institute. Brian Elderbroom, a senior research associate with the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. This is all in preparation for a Wednesday, October 15th webinar at 2 o'clock in the afternoon with the Urban Institute and the Bureau of Justice Assistance. We encourage everybody to go to the website, www.urban.org, www.urban.org, for the document I'm about to mention and the webinar, and I'll bring up the webinar a couple more times throughout the course of the program. Ryan and Brian, welcome to DC Public Safety.
Thanks for having us.
Well,
like I said, before we hit the record button, it's the Ryan and Brian show. It sounds like a morning drive time radio talk show host, you know, so it should be an interesting program. You did a report called Improving Recidivism as a Performance Measure, and I just want to read from it ever so briefly at the very beginning to kick off the conversation. Performance measurement, establishing metrics for success and assessing results, is a crucial first step in informed decisions made by all areas of government, including criminal justice policy. Understanding the outcomes of funding and policy decisions is critical to improving government performance and providing the best return on taxpayer investments. If that's true, Ryan or Brian, why don't we do it? Why do we in the criminal justice system, why are we so reluctant to be involved in measuring recidivism?
Well, I would say it's not a reluctance to be involved, but it's a little bit more about the way that we're doing it. The reason, the impetus behind doing this brief was a recognition that, for better or worse, recidivism is a primary performance measure that's being used in the field of corrections. And there are a lot of reasons why that's troubling. Practitioners and policymakers and researchers alike, I think, have a range of criticisms. But the recidivism as sort of an end measure, basically a measure of when somebody comes in the system, is that intervention while they're in the system having some sort of positive outcome and result that is leading to a reduction in future offending. And so if we have an imperfect measure, I think that Brian and I and other folks at the Urban Institute felt it was really important for us to try to sketch out ways that we could improve it, because it's not going away. And I think one of the key things is sort of flagged in right from the get-go, is that different folks have different criticisms about it. And I think the biggest issue is that every individual who comes into the system has a different story, they have a different history, and they're touched by a number of different parts of the system. And so recidivism traditionally is looked at as a measure of success for prisons. People coming into prison, do they succeed when they come back out again?
Well, I'm going to go over to Brian on this question. What we say, and I talked to a couple of practitioners from around the field saying I was going to do this radio show today with Urban, and they're saying, you know, Leonard, we have individuals that come to us in the criminal justice system, that come to us in community supervision. They have histories of substance abuse, histories of mental health problems, and they have a lousy job record. They spend a lot of time, in many cases, in the American prison system. Women offenders in particular come out and they have to deal with kids that really the odds are so stacked against them. And it's not as if we have the money and the wherewithal and the resources to remediate so many of the social problems that they bring to us. Why should we be held responsible for that person's success when we don't control all the variables that go into that person's success or failure? Answer that question for me, Brian.
Well, I think for those very dedicated professionals who are working with people involved in the criminal justice system, they care deeply about those outcomes that you're describing, mm-hmm. not just whether they desist from future criminal behavior, but whether they find stable housing, whether they find a job, whether they stop using drugs and alcohol. And those are important measures by which they should judge their success as well. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, what we outline in the brief is that a single statewide rate of recidivism obscures a lot of what you're describing in that comment. And we need to incorporate other success measures in addition to the ones that you've described. How long is someone successful? Mm-hmm. How many people are successful, not just how many people fail? Mm-hmm. What is our success rate at changing people's behavior? And that's a big part of what we outline in the brief.
Well, you're basically supporting what I'm hearing from the field, that you want those variables measured, that maybe you shouldn't be held responsible for everything if the person didn't not receive drug treatment, if that person did not receive mental health interventions, then you compare them against those who did and check the outcome. And if those people who didn't do worse than those people who did, that's a measurement that is very useful in terms of funding sources.
Absolutely. That's largely what the report is about, is comparing policy interventions, comparing the impacts of policies, and looking at people who receive certain treatments or receive certain changes to the way that they're supervised on community supervision or the intervention that they get through prison, to measure different populations to see what the impact is of policy and practice.
Ryan, not many states do this well, as far as I can see. I mean, I'm up on the criminal justice literature as much as anybody else. I'm aware of the Washington Institute for Public Policy. They've been before our microphones. I am aware of the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority that goes back decades in terms of doing a good job in terms of measurement. You give a couple of examples here, specifically Delaware and Pennsylvania within your report, but most states do not do a great job of measuring the success of people coming out of the prison system or measuring the success of people on parole and probation. Why is that?
I think that we haven't really sat down and outlined the steps that states need to put in place to measure. And so what the brief lays out is sort of four key areas that states should be defining recidivism in a broad way. I think that's one of the point that Brian was just making. We make it pretty clear. A central point of this is that we're talking about multiple measures of recidivism. There's no single right, quote-unquote, right measure of recidivism. How you measure recidivism depends very much on what type of questions you're trying to answer. There are improvements to collection, to types of analysis, and then to dissemination. And I would say that there are a lot of states that are doing good things, but in terms of a state that's pulling all of these different pieces together and being able to answer these key questions in a really rich and deep way, that's what I think is lacking, and that's what we're trying to point out with the brief.
And you know, most states, I imagine, aren't doing it for one particular reason. This is an expensive proposition. I mean, you need qualified people, you need money, you need time, you need data resources, you need to have the sanctity of the collection process to be unimpeachable. There are so many variables that go into good evaluations, but this is not an inexpensive proposition. This is something that states are going to say to themselves, okay, fine, I understand the need, I understand the desire, but you know, you're going to ask us to spend another $3 or $4 million a year to pull this off. We don't have $3 or $4 million a year to pull this off. So I would imagine expense and technical expertise is one of the reasons why states don't do this.
Yeah, I think we've talked about the fact that there are a number of different agencies that get involved and are responsible for recidivism. I think that's one of the biggest obstacles, is that you can't just go. Traditionally, what we see for recidivism comes out of departments of corrections from prisons, because that's usually where the data come from. We don't have the collections across law enforcement, across community supervision agencies, across state lines. I would say that the Bureau of Justice Statistics, whose work has been working on a major initiative to improve national collection of recidivism, has laid out some groundwork that I would like to think could help improve states' collection within their own borders. Mm-hmm. So there definitely are opportunities out there to engage. I think there's a lot of assistance there, particularly through some of the broader national efforts. But there's no question that it's going to take a serious commitment, and it's going to take a serious upgrading of databases. I mean, you know, and listeners will know that you know, in states, many of these agencies, the computers and databases don't speak with one another.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so it's very difficult to measure performance, to measure reoffending performance and any of the types of indicators that we've discussed, if you're not able to follow somebody through all the different systems that they touch.
To pick up on one of your points that you just mentioned, is that you're looking for a variety of agencies to come in and provide data. That way it's not just Division of Correction or parole and probation data. It's law enforcement. It's treatment provision. You're looking for as many data points as humanly possible with an offender who has one unique identifier, so everybody knows what they're talking about. So you're not talking about sharing privacy information, because you're not connecting that to a particular name. You're connecting it to a number, and it's just an aggregate. It's big data. It's what IBM, it's what Google, it's what Yahoo, it's what everybody else out there is doing, is what Apple is doing. They're using big data to drive policy decisions. That's exactly what you're talking about, doing nothing more besides bringing the big data concept to the criminal justice system.
Exactly. And unlike Google, which has access to large amounts of data through its own services, each of the different criminal justice actors have a different piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the challenge with recidivism is that, as Ryan said, we need data sets that speak to each other so that the agencies that have responsibility for supervision and incarceration have the data to measure reoffending that comes from law enforcement and other agencies that are collecting and housing that.
Okay, what we have in essence, if we have it at all, is an emulation of the Bureau of Justice Statistics data on recidivism. Their report just came out, about a little less than a year ago, the updated data. In essence, talking about 2/3 being arrested and 50% being reincarcerated, which is pretty much mimicking the two earlier data sets put out by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. But most states don't even have that. Most states don't even have that level of survey, that level of following to go 3 years out and take a look at broader recidivism. So you're saying that, number one, that's inadequate. Number two, you need to go much deeper than that. But, you know, first of all, most states don't do that, correct?
It's improving, and I think Ryan can probably talk to the National Corrections Reporting Program, which is where a large portion of the Bureau of Justice Statistics data comes from as well.
Okay.
Yeah, there has been a significant improvement in the recidivism measurement. There's also been a really significant improvement in the NCRP, the National Corrections Reporting Program, which has now been they're getting very close to 50 states reporting. They've been filling in back data, and this is an individual level data set that is actually structured in such a way that they're what are called term record files. So you can actually follow an individual over time from year to year. It's an annual survey from year to year and see how they flow through the system. So this gets back to your earlier point about if I'm in a state and I say, all right, you've sold me on this brief, but where am I going to get the money to get all this stuff, these data together?
Right.
We don't have the money to build this capacity. I'd like to see some exploration of some opportunities between some of the data collection work that's going on within the Bureau of Justice Statistics. So there's not replication, but it's important that you get this relationship where you're reporting data up for national reporting, but you're getting something out of it. That's going to get obviously more buy-in from the state and locals.
We're getting better at doing it as the larger recidivism data. The second point I wanted to bring up is, do we really want to know? I mean, the individual discrete variables in terms of recidivism requires us to measure how well we're doing in terms of our drug treatment programs, in terms of our employment programs, in terms of mental health programs, in terms of how we supervise, what we supervise. A lot of folks are scared to know how well they're doing because, I mean, look, national recidivism data is pretty consistent in terms of 50% coming back to the prison system, 2/3 being rearrested. The question is, do we really want to know? Do state administrators really want to know how well they're doing? Because that, if there's an indication of failure in terms of how well they're doing, and you gave a wonderful example about Pennsylvania figuring out that their community correction centers were not doing nearly as well as they could be, should be, so they rearranged the parameters of their contracts with, I'm assuming, private providers, saying that, look, you know, you're going to have to do better for us to continue funding. That's exactly the sort of smart, big data approach you guys are talking about. But do we in the criminal justice system really want to know how well we're doing and how well we're not doing?
Well, the fact is that decisions are being made with the existing recidivism data that we're using right now. So people are making decisions about specific policies based on broad measures. So if you're dealing with, let's say you've got a program or a policy that's dealing with drug offenders, a specific slice of the drug offender population in your state, and you're looking at the recidivism rates for all drug offenders in your state and saying, oh, well, they've gone up. This has clearly been a failure. Well, you don't necessarily, a huge part of that population was not participating in this program.
Mm-hmm.
But you could very quickly see how policymakers will make decisions. They will shift funding around. We're very much seeing that in the current budget crisis and the current tightness in many states is moving dollars from spot to spot looking for things that work. So we're already using these data as is, and that's why I think we felt really strong that we want to get a brief out there talking about improving it. It's not going away. It is warts and all the best performance measure that we have, or at least the most frequently used one. Let's improve it. There are ways we can do it in with meaningful ways without major overhaul. Some of the stuff we're talking about here is really big picture, and it's an ideal. And I don't want to give the impression to listeners that you need to do all of these things things or nothing. It is not all or nothing. And I think the brief lays out some really small things as well as some really big, more ambitious things. But each step along the way is an improvement over the status quo, because it's important to know policymakers now are making decisions about policies using existing data. And in many cases, those data are telling misleading stories.
Don't we need to be held accountable, do we not? Those of us in the criminal justice system, don't we need to be held accountable?
Absolutely. And I think for community supervision practitioners in particular, who have the firsthand of experience of working with people who have been released from prison in particular, and feel like they have a better opportunity to change their behavior through the intervention of community supervision than that person would have received while incarcerated or if they had not gone to prison at all. And I think it's important for, in particular, people who provide those services, whether it's supervision or treatment or otherwise, to be able to compare the effectiveness of what they're doing to prison,
sure,
in particular as an alternative. And one of the things that is laid out in the brief is that in order to do that, you need to statistically control for the population that you're studying. And that's something that almost no states are doing right now. And it would be great if we got to the point where we could compare probation as an intervention to prison as an intervention using some of the statistical techniques that we talk about in the brief.
It could save states literally tens of millions of dollars, but we're more than halfway through the program. Let me reintroduce you, ladies and gentlemen. We're doing a program today on measuring recidivism with the Urban Institute. We're here with Ryan King, Senior Fellow of the Justice Policy Center at Urban, and Brian Elderbroom, Senior Research Associate of the Justice Policy Center at Urban. Remind everybody that this coming Wednesday, October 15th, there's a webinar on this topic with Urban and the Bureau of Justice Assistance. You can find information on Urban's website, www.urban.org, www.urban.org. Let me get back to the program, gentlemen. We discussed before the program Joan Petersilia, who I interviewed before these microphones a couple times and hopefully will interview in 2015 once again, who simply said that we within the criminal justice system overpromise and underdeliver when it comes to intervention. In terms of the populations that we're dealing with, that we really haven't lived up to our promise in terms of really lowering recidivism by numbers that we would like to see. And she's suggesting that we're promising too much, delivering too little, and that may bite us, cause us problems in the near future. So to do that, the only way of figuring that out is by doing good recidivism research as to whether or not we are overpromising and under-delivering, correct?
Doing good research and making it targeted to answer specific policy-relevant questions. And I would flag there's some really new and interesting work that I encourage your listeners to go check out. There's a new journal article out using some of these NCRP data that I mentioned earlier. So they're able to actually follow individuals through the system. And they sort of flip recidivism on its head a little bit. And I think it's important for us to think about that in our conversation here. And looking at the proportion of individuals who go into prison for a first time, come out and never reoffend again, basically people who desist. And they find that in upwards of 60% of those individuals who go in a first time don't come back again. And so the takeaway point from this is one that I think is not necessarily revelatory, but it is worth raising again, which is that the recidivism rates that are the 40 or 50% that we see are generally driven by a smaller portion of the population who churn through the system, either through new crimes or revocations from community supervision. Mm-hmm. And so one of the pieces is that there are things that do work, and we certainly need to ask questions for these 6 and 10 who don't return about why are they not returning, and importantly, did they ever need to go to prison to begin with, or would have they desisted on their own through some other sanctions or no criminal justice involvement. But for the 4 and 10, the people who are churning through, who Al Bloomstein and Alan Beck referred to as a reentry, as this transient moment between confinement and the community, essentially for individuals, this becomes their life. We don't know enough about that population. We haven't asked the right questions about that population to find the right sort of interventions. And so I do think that part of what we talk about here is multiple recidivism measures and fine-tuning them so that let's talk about the 6 and 10 who desist. Let's also look at these 4 and 10, the different types of individuals, how many times have they been in. We have to have the type of recidivism data that can be that granular to be able to really understand these subpopulations. And I do think certainly that Joan is correct, that right now if we're looking around and saying, oh, it's 4-10 and it's a failure, it's always been 4-10, we need to unpack that 4-10 a little bit and see what's under there. Some people are failing, some people might be succeeding. Let's learn from the successes, let's fine-tune the failures.
The report, again, is Improving Recidivism as a Performance Measure, again, available through the website at www.urban.org. All right, where do we go to from here? Now, you're going to be doing this seminar, and you're going to be talking to a lot of people in the system. They're cynical. Oh, God, here we go. I mean, I had this discussion just with my folks upstairs before doing this radio show. Probably my biggest criticism by people in the field about what it is that I do on the radio and the television side is, Leonard, you bring these folks in from NIJ and Urban and Pew and Justice, and they talk about these wonderful, grandiose ideas for the rest of us. Wow, don't they understand what it is that we're dealing with out here? I mean, with huge caseloads and no money for treatment and no money. I mean, so we're going to measure what? Our ineptitude, our lack of resources, our lack of public confidence as to why we don't have the money to really impact the lives of the people on our caseloads. How do you respond to them? They're frustrated. What you're talking about is a very detailed big data policy. They're talking about, for the love of God, Leonard, I have a caseload of 150 to 1, 250 to 1. How am I supposed to meaningfully intervene in the lives of these people when I have these large caseloads? When are the folks from Urban and Pew and everybody else going to deal with my reality? So their reality is, I'm going to guess, as what I said before, they don't have the money nor the wherewithal to do the sort of measurement that you're talking about. But if they don't, policy mistakes are going to continue to be made. Tens of millions of dollars or even billions of dollars could be wasted, correct?
Sure. Here's the thing that I think, and some of that frustration and hopelessness comes from the fact that we really are using these blunt and imprecise recidivism measures. And so you're right. You're doing good work, and you may actually, let's put aside caseload, let's say you're actually doing good work and having a positive impact, but an overall statewide recidivism measure is not going to point that out. So you're not going to be able to draw attention on that. What I think is important about this is that the types of things and steps that we point out in the report, and again, it's important to note that there's a lot of things that are big and ambitious, but there are also small steps that can be taken. Those actually can help individuals in the correctional system. They're designed in a way so that the idea that I shouldn't be held accountable for the 10 different systems that have touched the person's life, why should I be the one that's held accountable? We're talking about doing a level of analysis that controls and identifies and is precise enough so that people are being held accountable for their particular steps, their particular interventions in the system. And it's important to note that a lot of this stuff is already going on in states. So we have examples in the report. There are other states. We're having this webinar. It's primarily focused at practitioners and individuals working in the states to get an opportunity. So some of this stuff, it sounds big, and when the way we're talking about it here, you know, it sounds ominous, and there's no way I can do that. But I think you'll find that there are states out there that are able to make some really positive impacts, and we're going to share some of those stories on the webinar of states that are able to use their existing capacity. Some of it isn't necessarily, they may already have the data collection capacity. They just haven't thought about doing the analysis in this way. Mm-hmm. They've just done it one way forever, and they just keep doing it. Mm-hmm. But with some minor modifications and trying to get some people from states to talk with one another, we can make some of these improvements.
But let me talk a little bit about how one of the measures we outline in the report can actually feed into a policy conversation in a way that helps practitioners. Mm-hmm. So one of the measures we talk about is time to failure. Mm-hmm. And the research from many people shows that people are most likely to fail in the days, weeks, and months shortly after release.
Right.
And the vast majority of people who go on to commit another crime after being released from prison do so in the first year after they've been released. That's an important finding. It's an important recidivism finding. And what we can learn from that is that supervision terms of 3, 5, 10 years are not effectively deterring criminal reoffending. Mm-hmm. And so what we need is to reduce caseloads to the point where we're really focusing on those people who are highest risk and the people who are going to need the most help when they first leave prison. And that's how using a new recidivism measure like time to failure can inform policy in a way that helps practitioners focus on the people who need supervision and interventions the most.
You know, it's intriguing. Is there the possibility, and one of you brought it up before, of the idea of community supervision being as effective or more effective than incarceration itself? itself. Incarceration rates have gone back up after a lull since 2009, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. Some people have suggested, well, we're not doing the job we need to do at the state and local and county level in terms of proving how viable we are. That we're just not convincing people that we say we over-incarcerate, we say we incarcerate for too long, we hold people for too long, that the fiscal burden on the states is enormous. I mean, virtually every governor in the country has had a discussion with his or her corrections administrator that you've got to bring down the budget, you've got to do something about recidivism. The only way we're going to do any of this is to do good research. I mean, how else are we supposed to manage the criminal justice system and relieve states of this enormous burden that they're crying about? How else are we going to do that unless we do good research?
And we need to know what works. There are states, recidivism rates can go up and they can go down completely independent of any policy changes. That's one of the important things we really point out in there. As the profile of a prison population becomes more or less risk, more or less risky, then you're going to have recidivism rates. And so the question is, did my recidivism rate go down because I'm releasing individuals who were at very low risk of reoffending versus prior release cohorts? Mm-hmm. Or did it go down because we're putting in place appropriate policy interventions and evidence-based practices to address recidivism?
The Washington State Institute for Public Policy found that because they were saying it's not a measure of not doing it well, but that we were releasing people at a higher risk, thereby those people at a higher risk are going to recidivate more. It's not the policy, it's the people, correct?
It's exactly. That's exactly what we talk about that example in our report. It's a perfect example. And another one, and some prior work looking at recidivism rates at Oregon and Oklahoma were two states that had recidivism rates down in the mid-20%, some of the lowest in the country. One of them, Oregon, had taken very deliberate steps to try to address recidivism. And so you talk to people in the state and they would point to some of those practices. They identified recidivism as a problem and they wanted solutions. Oklahoma, on the other hand, you talk to individuals who work with data there and they said they were filling their prisons up with very low-risk people. And so naturally their recidivism rates were low. And so those are two very different policy conversations. If you're mm-hmm. not controlling for that underlying population and don't know that, how can you possibly be making informed decisions about directions of your recidivism right. where to invest your resources?
You can save literally millions, tens of millions, billions of dollars over time if you have the data to guide you. You can protect public safety better if you have the data to guide you.
I think, without question, I think we're seeing that now, and that's why it is an exciting time. That's why I think it's a good time for this brief, because in a time where we have more research and more data and better guidance about what works, the question now is, you know, how can states invest their resources? And one of the first steps they need to be able to do is identify drivers of the population and put in place some of these practices. So you do need these data, mm-hmm. but there are many different steps. And as I said, there's sort of an ideal perfect system that nobody has, but there are a lot of steps that states can take now with a limited amount of additional resources that can really improve their understanding of recidivism in their state?
This is a terribly unfair question to ask either one of you, but does Office of Justice Programs, BJS, Bureau of Justice Assistance, is anybody prepared? I know that the federal government has put tons of money into state analytical centers throughout the years to improve the quality of their data, but do we have the technical assistance and the funding at hand to help states come to grips with what you're suggesting?
Well, first of all, I would say that BJA supported this brief, and they're in support of this work, so I think that's a great mm-hmm. sign right yep. there. And certainly in conversations we have there, there's an acknowledgement and understanding from folks in BJA about the importance of this issue, and we'll certainly continue to carry that message over there. So that's a great area where we love to support. And I think, again, the work that BJS has been doing to improve recidivism and their partnership with APT and NCRP data collection has been absolutely fantastic. There's enormous improvement that are not just for national level, but can have benefits for the states. So there's a lot of leadership and understanding. This issue is not news to anybody working on this issue here in Washington. And what we're hoping to accomplish with this webinar is to get folks in the state aware of it. And hopefully there can be opportunities down the road for additional mm-hmm. leadership and guidance and support from the federal government for states.
Brian, did you have 30 seconds left? Did you have anything to add to that?
No, I think, you know, one of your first comments was that these are professionals who are, for the most part, overworked and under-resourced. And I think that's an important point to make. And part of what we are trying to do with this brief is to help practitioners communicate their success.
This has been a fascinating conversation, and I really do want to encourage everybody this Wednesday, October 15th, the webinar on this issue of measuring recidivism with the Urban Institute and the Bureau of Justice Assistance at 2 o'clock. Go to the website, www.urban.org, www.urban.org, where our guests today have been Ryan King and Brian Elderbroom from the wonderful Urban Institute, and I really appreciate both of you being here. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We do appreciate your comments. We even appreciate your criticisms, and we want everybody to have yourselves a very, very pleasant day.